and the crust of floating impurities was skimmed off, the molten metal mixture would be used to cast useful items for the mother school, like proverbial swords beaten into plowshares. Although the Bene Gesserit had eliminated any possibility of the invisibility generator being rebuilt by outsiders, Arishka still felt uneasy. Her sisters had studied the crashed ship in detail, and though they didn't understand how to reassemble the pieces, they maintained an accurate mental record of every scrap. Someday they would transfer the information into other memory. There, locked within the collective consciousness of the Bene Gesserit, it would remain sealed forever. The last sisters in the procession tossed pieces into the crucible, and the only no-ship in existence vanished forever. It is difficult to make power lovable. This is the dilemma of all governments. Padishah Emperor Hasik III, Private Khitan Journals. The Harkonnen banquet was more extravagant than any previously staged on Gedi Prime. After surviving the severe tutoring of Mephistus crew, the Baron didn't know if he ever wanted to undergo such an ordeal again. "How you are perceived in the Landsraad, my Baron," Peter de Vries reminded him in a soothing, reasonable voice. "Remember how Leto Atreides is revered, how they applaud him for his drastic action on Baikal. Your advantage." Upon combing through the names on the list, the etiquette advisor had been horrified to see that blood rivals had been invited from Grumman and Ekaz. It would be like a sonic grenade waiting for the pulse of its primer. After discussion and outright argument, the Baron finally agreed to drop Archduke Armand Ekaz from the invitations, and de Vries scuttled about to make the changes so that the banquet could proceed without problems. The Mentat still worried that he would be executed at the conclusion of the festivities. Noting the man's obvious unease, the Baron smiled to himself. He liked to keep people off balance, fearing for their positions and their very lives. The evening's carefully selected guests were ferried down from orbit by a Harkonnen shuttle. Resplendent in billowing clothes that concealed both his girth and his suspensor belt, the Baron stood under the ornamental portcullis of his keep. Gleaming in the smoky orange dusk of Harko City, the sharp iron spikes of the gate hung like dragon fangs, poised to chomp down on visitors. As noble guests emerged from the suspensor-borne transportation barge, the Baron smiled graciously and welcomed each of them with rehearsed, exceedingly polite phrases. When he thanked them personally for coming, several men regarded him with suspicion, as if he were speaking a foreign language. The Baron had been forced to allow the representatives an armed bodyguard, one for each nobleman. Mephistus' crew had been loath to make the concession, but the nobles had refused to come otherwise. The fact was they simply did not trust the Harkonnens. Even now, as the distinguished visitors stood together inside the ebony-walled reception foyer, they spoke with careful words, curious about what House Harkonnen truly wanted of them.
"Welcome! Welcome, my esteemed guests!"
The Baron raised his ring-studded hands.
"Our families have been associated for generations, yet few of us can call each other friends. I mean to add a bit more civility to interactions among the Landsraad houses."
He smiled, feeling as if his lips might break, knowing that many of these people would probably have cheered if Duke Leto Atreides had said the same thing. Furrowed brows, lips pinched into frowns, eyes filled with questions. Crew had written the remarks for him, and the words clawed at the Baron's throat.
"I see this news is surprising to you, but I promise, on my honor," he continued quickly before anyone could snicker at that comment, "that I intend to ask nothing of you. I only wish to share an evening of joy and fellowship, so that you might return home with a better opinion of House Harkonnen.
Old Count Ilban Ratchiz raised his hands and applauded. His blue eyes sparkled with delight.
"Hear, hear, Baron Harkonnen. I heartily endorse your sentiments. I knew you had a soft spot in you."
Stiffly, the Baron nodded his appreciation, though he had always considered Ilban Ratchiz to be a vapid man who focused on unimportant matters, such as the inane hobbies of his grown children. As a consequence, House Ratchiz had not adequately exploited the decline of House Vernius and the Ixian Industrial Empire. Still, an ally was an ally. Luckily for House Ratchiz, their premier, Ein Kalimar, was quite competent enough to keep the technological facilities busy even in times of adversity. The thought of Kalimar made the Baron scowl, though. The two of them had conducted business on several occasions, but lately the bespectacled politician did little more than nag him about money House Harkonnen supposedly owed for the services of the Sukh Dr. Wellington Yue, money the Baron never intended to pay.
"Peace and fellowship. Such a pleasant sentiment, Baron," added Viscount Hundro Maritani, his thick mane of black hair swirling around his head, his eyebrows heavy, his eyes dark and intent. "Not something any of us expected from House Harkonnen."
The Baron tried to maintain his smile.
"Well, I'm turning over a new leaf."
The Viscount always added an unsettling edge to his comments, as if a rabid dog were chained to his soul. Hundro Maritani had a habit of leading the Grumman people on fanatical, often ill-advised strikes, flouting the rules of the Imperium, and lashing out at anyone who dared challenge him. The Baron might have considered him an ally if Grumman's actions weren't so annoyingly unpredictable. A red-headed master of arms, wearing the impressive formal badge of a trained graduate of Ginaz, stood next to the Viscount. The other nobles had brought along muscular bodyguards, but Hundro Maritani seemed much more impressed to bring his own pet swordmaster. He, Iresser, had been the only Grumman trainee to complete the full schooling on Ginaz. The redhead looked uneasy, though, clinging to duty like a lifeline. The Baron considered the advantages. House Harkonnen had no devoted swordmaster. He wondered if he should send a few of his own candidates to Ginaz. Gliding on his suspensers, taking gentle steps, he led his guests through the main levels of the keep. The course facility had been decorated with bouquets of sweetly pungent off-world flowers, since available Gedi prime floral arrangements were disappointing, according to the etiquette advisor. As a consequence, the Baron could scarcely breathe in his own halls. The big man gestured, wearing the flowing sleeves of a gentleman of leisure. He led the way into the reception hall, where servants carried trays of drinks in balut crystal goblets. On a low platform, three music masters from Chusuk, friends of Mephistus' crew, played sprightly background melodies on fine balisettes. The Baron flitted among the guests, joining in dull conversations with them, maintaining the illusion of civility, and hating every moment of it. After a few drinks laced with melange, the guests gradually relaxed and began chatting about Choam directorships, animal harvests on backwater planets, or loathsome spacing guild tariffs and regulations. The Baron consumed two snifters of Kirana brandy, double the limit crew had attempted to impose on him. But he didn't care. These proceedings were interminable. The smile was hurting his face. The moment dinner was announced, the Baron guided the diners into the banquet hall, eager to move on from this endless, inane conversation. Count Ratchiz chattered incessantly about his children and grandchildren, as if anyone could keep track of them all. He seemed to hold no grudge against House Harkonnen for superseding them in spice operations on Arrakis decades ago. The noble nincompoop had lost much wealth through his incompetence, and wasn't even bothered by it. The guests took their designated seats after bodyguards had checked for booby traps. The banquet table was a plateau of darkly polished alaka wood, shimmering with islands of fine porcelain and floating clusters of wine goblets. The display of food was breathtaking, the smells mouth-watering. Beatific boys with milky skin stood behind the chairs, a designated attendant for every invited guest. The Baron had chosen these servants himself, street urchins drugged into submission, and then cleaned up. The immense host moved to a wide, customized chair at the head of the table and summoned the first course of appetizers. He had placed chronometers all around the banquet hall so he could watch every second tick by. He couldn't wait for it to be over. Inside the listening alcove, Rabban eavesdropped on party conversations. He had been swiveling the parabolic microphone from one blathering mouth to another, hoping to discover embarrassing gossip, accidentally divulged secrets. The sheer dullness made him want to vomit. Everyone was on guard, careful with their words. He learned nothing at all. Rabban was frustrated. "This is even more boring than actually participating," he snapped at the mentat, who fidgeted beside him, studying the listening devices. Lowering his eyebrows, De Vries scowled at him. "As a mentat, I have no choice but to memorize every single tedious moment, every line, while your simple brain will forget it all within a few days." "I'm counting my blessings," Rabban said with a smirk. On the high-resolution monitors, they watched the main course being served. Rabban's thick-lipped mouth watered, knowing he'd receive only leftovers. But if that was the price of being excused from this chattering aviary of strutting birds, he would gladly suffer it. Even eating cold food was preferable to civility. Behind the scenes, yet still a busybody attending to 1,000 details, Mephistus' crew scampered into the spy alcove, thinking it was a dinnerware storage room. He stopped, startled to encounter Rabban and De Vries. Swallowing hard, Crew touched his neck unconsciously, where thick layers of powder masked the heavy bruises from Rabban's recent stranglehold. "Oh, excuse me," he said, finding his composure. "I didn't mean to interrupt." He nodded at De Vries, whom he erroneously considered an ally. "The banquet is proceeding quite nicely, I believe. The Baron is doing a fine job." Beast Rabban growled, and Mephistus' crew scurried out. De Vries and Rabban resumed their listening duties, wishing for something to happen before the night was completely wasted. "What a lovely child!" Count Rachis gushed upon seeing Phaedratha. The fair-haired boy knew plenty of words and already understood how to get what he wanted. The Count extended his arms. "May I hold him?" At the Baron's nod, a servant brought Phaedratha to the old Rachisian, who bounced him on his grandfatherly knee. Phaed didn't giggle, which surprised Ilban. The Count then lifted his wine glass, while supporting Phaed with one arm. "I propose a toast to children." The guests drank to this. Grumbling to himself, the Baron wondered if Phaed might need his diaper changed, and if the old fool would be quite so happy to perform those menial duties. At that moment, Phaed burbled a stream of nonsense words, which the Baron understood were names for his own excrement. Ilban, however, didn't know that, and simply smiled and repeated the words back to the boy. He bounced Phaed again, and exclaimed in a childish voice, "Look, little one, they're bringing dessert now. You like that, don't you?" The Baron leaned forward, pleased that the meal was about to conclude, and because he had planned this part of the banquet himself, making his own decisions without listening to the guidance of the etiquette advisor. It was, he thought, a very clever idea that the guests might find amusing. Carrying a platform large enough to hold a human body, six servants brought in a 2-meter-long cake, which they placed in the middle of the table. The concoction was curved and narrow, shaped like a sandworm, and decorated with powdered swirls of potent melange. "This confection symbolizes Harkonnen Holdings on Arrakis. Celebrate with me our decades of profitable work in the desert." The Baron beamed, and Count Richies applauded with all the others, though even he must not have missed the insult directed toward his family's earlier failures. Frosting seemed to shimmer, and the Baron waited for the delightful surprise inside.
"There, look at the cake, little one." Ilban placed Fade on the table in front of him,
an action that no doubt would have horrified Mephistus' crew. One of the chef's assistants used a wire knife to slice open the length of the sweet sandworm, as if he were performing an autopsy. The banquet guests crowded around to get better views, and Count Richies leaned Fade forward. When the cake was opened, shapes squirmed inside, long, writhing forms, serpentine creatures meant to represent the sandworms of Arrakis. The harmless snakes had been drugged and stuffed inside the cake, so that as they roiled and squirmed out of the frosting, they looked like a nest of tentacles. A wonderful little joke. Fade seemed fascinated, but Count Richies choked on a scream. The tension of the night and the guests' suspicions about the Baron had placed everyone on edge. The Count, trying to be a hero, yanked Fade Rautha roughly away from the table, overturning his own chair in the process. Fade, who had not been afraid of the snakes, was now startled into a fit of bawling. As he wailed, bodyguards grabbed their lords and prepared to defend them. On the other side of the table from the toddler, Viscount Mauritani stood back, his black eyes glittering with an odd mixture of mirth and fury. Swordmaster Hii Resser stood ready to protect his lord, but Mauritani seemed unconcerned. The Viscount coolly adjusted a bracelet on his wrist, causing a white-hot beam from a covert lasgun to vaporize the snakes, detonating them into shreds of scaly flesh, chunks of meat, and blackened frosting. Guests screamed. Most rushed for the doors of the banquet hall. Mephistus' crew scampered in from a back room, waving his hands and pleading for calm. From that point on, the pandemonium only grew worse. The more tightly packed the group, the greater the need for strict social ranks and orders. Bene Gesserit teaching. Dressed in a traditional Jubba cloak, with the hood thrown back, Leet Kynes stood once again on a high balcony overlooking the Siege Chamber. He felt far more at home here than in the halls of Kytane, and far more intimidated. Here he would speak of matters that affected the future of every free man on the planet of Dune. The sessions had gone smoothly, with the exception of a disruption caused by Pimak, the aging Naib of Hole-in-the-Wall Siege. The conservative leader spoke against everything Leet stood for, resisting all forms of change, but providing no rational alternatives. Other Fremen repeatedly shouted him down, until, at last, the obstinate old man had skulked off into the cool shadows, grumbling. For days the convocation had shifted and flowed, with some feuding members leaving the meeting in indignation, but later returning. Each night, after the meetings, Farula had held Leet, whispering her advice, helping where she could, and loving him. She kept him strong and balanced, despite his growing discouragement. Fremen observers reported the subtle progress in their battle to tame the desert. In only a single generation, the wasteland was showing faint but definite signs of improvement. 20 years ago, Umma Kynes had told them to be patient, that the effort might take centuries. But his dreams were already beginning to come true. In deep arroyos at the far southern regions, cleverly concealed plantings thrived, nurtured by solar mirrors and magnifiers that warmed the air and melted frost from the ground. Stunted palm trees grew in small numbers, along with hardy desert sunflowers, gourd plants, and tubers. On some days, a few trickles of water ran freely. Water on the surface of dune. It was an astounding concept. So far, the Harkonnens hadn't noticed the changes, with their attention directed only toward spice operations. The planet would be recovered, 1 hectare at a time. Good news all around. Pete heaved a sigh of anticipation. Even with all the support he had received at this convocation, much more than he had expected, there might be significant dissent this afternoon, after they heard his proposal. On balconies and platforms that zigzagged up the rock walls, more than 1,000 ripcord-tough Fremen returned from a midday break and took up their positions. They wore desert-stained robes and timag boots. Some smoked melange-laced fibers in clay pipes, as was the custom in early afternoon. With the pleasing aroma of burning spice in his nostrils, Liet Kynes began to speak. "Amma Kynes, my father, was a great visionary. He set our people on an ambitious, arduous course to awaken Dune. He taught us that the ecosystem is complex, that every life form needs a niche. Many times he spoke of the ecological consequences of our actions. Amma Kynes saw the environment as an interactive system, with fluid stability and order." Leet cleared his throat. "From off-planet we have brought insects to aerate the soil, which enables plants to grow more easily. We have centipedes, scorpions, and bees. Small and large animals are spreading across the sand and rocks. Kit foxes, hares, desert hawks, dwarf owls. Dune is like a great engine that we are oiling and repairing. One day this world will serve us in new and wondrous ways, just as we will continue to honor and serve it. My Fremen brothers, we are part of the ecosystem ourselves, an integral part. We occupy our own essential niche." The audience listened attentively, with a special reverence whenever Leet mentioned the name and work of his legendary father. "But what is our niche? Are we merely planetologists, restoring flora and fauna? I say we must do much more than that. We need to fight the Harkonnen aggressors on a scale never before contemplated. For years, groups of us have harassed them, but never enough to cripple their rapacious operations. Today, the Baron steals more spice than ever." Shouts of discontent passed through the chamber, accompanied by pockets of nervous whispering against the sacrilege. Leet raised his voice. "My father failed to foresee that powerful forces of the Imperium, the Emperor, House Harkonnen, the Landsrad, would not share his vision. We are alone in this, and we must make them stop." The murmurings increased. Leet hoped he was awakening his people, convincing them to put aside their differences and work toward a common goal. "What good is it to build a home if you don't defend it? We are millions strong. Let us fight for the new world my father envisioned, a world our grandchildren should inherit." Applause echoed in the great chamber, as well as the foot stomping that signaled approval, especially from the rough Fremen youths, who reveled in their Razzia raids. Then Kynes heard a change in the noise. People pointed at an opposite balcony, where a wiry old man waved his kris knife in the air. Ropey hair whipped around him, making him look like a madman from the deep desert. Pemak again. "Takwa!" he shouted from his balcony, an ancient Fremen battle cry that meant, "The price of freedom!" The throng fell silent, all eyes riveted on the Naib of Hole-in-the-Wall Siege and his milky white blade. Fremen tradition held that a drawn kris knife could not be sheathed until it tasted blood. Pemak had chosen a dangerous course. Leet touched the handle of his own knife at his waist. He saw Stilgar and Turok making their way up a rock staircase, hurrying to the higher level.
"Leet Kynes, I challenge you to answer me!" Pimmok bellowed. "If I do not find your response satisfactory, the time for words will be over, and blood will decide. Do you accept my challenge?"
This fool could destroy all of the political progress Leet had made. With no choice in the matter, since his honor and ability to lead were at stake, Leet shouted back,
"If that will silence you, Pimmok, then I accept. There is no man so blind as one who has made up his mind."
A ripple of muffled laughter stirred through the audience at the skillful application of an old Fremen adage. Angry at the rebuke, Pimmok pointed with the tip of his blade.
"You are only half Fremen, Leet Kynes, and your off-world blood has infused you with devilish ideas. You have spent too much time on Seleucus Secundus and Kytane. You have been corrupted, and are now trying to taint the rest of us with your harmful delusions."
Its heart hammered in his chest. Righteous anger rose, and he wanted to silence the man. Glancing back, he saw Stilgar take a guard position at the entrance to Leet's balcony. The dissenter continued.
"For decades, Hynar, the Naib of Redwall Siege, has been my friend. I fought alongside him against the Harkonnens when they first came to Dune, after the departure of House Richeese. I carried him on my back after the raid in which he lost an eye. Hynar increased the prosperity of the people under his rule. But he is old, like me. Now you gather support from other Fremen leaders, bringing them here to solidify your position. You speak of your father's achievements, Leet Kynes, while citing none of your own."
The defiant man trembled with fury.
"Your motives are clear. You wish to be Naib yourself."
Leet blinked in surprise at the ridiculous assertion.
"I deny it completely. For weeks I have spoken of important work for all Fremen, and you accuse me of petty ambition?"
Stilgar shouted then, his voice clear in the huge chamber.
"It is said that if 1,000 men gather in a room, one of them is sure to be a fool. I believe there are 1,000 men here, Pimmok, and we have found our fool."
A few chuckles diminished the tension, but Pimmok did not relent.
"You are not a Fremen, Leet Kynes. You are not one of us. First you married Hynar's daughter, and now you intend to take his place. I hurl the truth back at you, Pimmok, and may it pierce your lying heart. My off-world blood comes from Umma Kynes himself, and you call that a weakness? Moreover, the tale of my blood brother Warwick and how he died is known in every Siege. I gave my vow to him that I would marry Ferula and take his son as my own."
Pimmok countered in a somber tone.
"Perhaps you summon the wind of the demon in the open desert to kill your rival. I do not pretend to know the powers of off-world demons."
Tired of the foolishness, Leet turned his gaze out upon the delegates lining the chamber.
"I have accepted his challenge, but he only plays games of words. If there is a duel between us, will I draw blood first, or will he? Pimmok is an old man, and if I kill him, I can only dishonor myself in such a fight. Even if he dies, he achieves his aim."
Leet looked across at the balcony.
"Is that your plan, old fool?"
Just then, Naib Hynar, wearing his eye patch and looking as if his body were made of leather, stepped onto the balcony beside Pimmok. The dissenter reacted with surprise, then disbelief, as the one-eyed Naib spoke. Einar's raspy voice rang through the gathering chamber.
"I have known Leet since the moment of his birth, and he has played no tricks against me. He has inherited the true vision of his father, and he is as much a Fremen as any of us."
He turned toward the wild-haired man beside him, who still gripped his kris knife, holding it high.
My old friend Pemak believes he speaks on my behalf. But I say to him, he must think beyond the concerns of a single Sich to all of Dune. I would rather see Harkonnen blood spilled than the blood of my comrade or of my son-in-law.
In the ensuing silence, Leet called out,
I will walk into the desert and face Shai-Hulud alone rather than fight a single one of you. You must either believe in me or cast me out.
A chanting filled the chamber, begun by Stilgar and Turok, and picked up by the brash Fremen youths thirsty for Harkonnen blood. More than 1,000 desert men uttered his Sich name over and over.
Leet! Leet!
On the opposite balcony there was a sudden blur of movement, a scuffle between Pemak and Hainar. Without saying a word, the stubborn man attempted to fall on his own naked blade. But old Hainar moved to prevent it. He snatched the kris-knife out of the sweat-slippery hand of his comrade. Pemak fell onto the balcony floor, alive, but defeated. Holding the knife, Hainar stepped back, slicing upward with a blur to cut a deep gash across Pemak's forehead, which would leave a scar for the rest of his days. The requisite blood had been drawn. Pemak looked up, the fury deflated from him. A line of blood dripped across his hooded brows and into his eyes. Einar turned the kris-knife around and extended it to its owner, hilt first.
"Perceive this as a good omen, all of you gathered here," Einar shouted into the cavern, "for it unifies the Fremen behind Leet Kynes."
Climbing to his feet, Pemak wiped crimson from his eyes, smearing his cheeks with streaks of blood like war paint. He drew a deep breath to speak, as was his right. Leet braced himself, still stunned at the speed with which events had turned. But the wild-haired Fremen scowled at Hainar, then said,
"I move that we elect Leet Kynes as our Abu Naib, the father of all Sieches, to lead us all."
Leet reeled for a moment, but after he had composed himself, he responded, "We are at a crisis point in our history. Our descendants will look at this moment and say either that we made the correct decision or that we failed entirely." After pausing to let this sink in, he continued,
"As the awakening of Dune becomes more obvious, it will be increasingly difficult to hide our work from the Harkonnens. The Guild spice bribe becomes more important than ever. To make certain we keep all weather satellites and observation systems away from our work."
Murmurs of concurrence passed through the throng. The weeks of discussion had come down to this. Leet Kynes tried to keep his emotions in check.
"After the treachery that resulted in the destruction of the smuggler base at the South Pole, I no longer trust the middleman we have used for years, the water merchant Rondo Tuic. Though he has left the Pole, he still acts as our liaison. But Tuic betrayed Dominic Vernius and could turn on us just as easily. Why trust him any longer? I will demand a direct meeting with a representative of the Spacing Guild. The Fremen will no longer rely on any middlemen. From now on, the standing agreement is between us and the Guild."
Leet had always considered Dominic Vernius a friend and mentor. The renegade Earl deserved a better fate than the one arranged for him by the double-dealing water merchant. Recently, Tuic had sold his ice mining operations to Lingar Butte, his former right-hand man, and returned to Carthag. Considering the problems of Tuic, Leet Kynes formed a plan to settle the matter. Around the chamber, the planetologist noted expressions of complete faith that he had not witnessed since the heady days of his celebrated father. This had been a long time coming, and the younger Kynes had traveled his own path. His aspirations overlapped with those of his predecessor, but went far beyond them. Where his father had envisioned only the greening of the desert wastelands, Leet considered the Fremen to be the stewards of Dune. All of it. To achieve greatness, though, they must first free themselves from their Harkonnen shackles. The The human body is a storehouse of relics from the past. The appendix, thymus, and, in the embryo, a gill structure. But the unconscious mind is even more intriguing. It has been built up over millions of years and represents a history throughout its synaptic traces, some of which do not appear to be useful in modern times. It is difficult to find everything that is there. From a secret Bene Gesserit symposium on other memory. Late at night, while the auroras still burned bright, a sleepless Anirul entered the austere, chill quarters that had been used by the Emperor's former truthsayer, Lobia. Nearly 2 months had passed since the old woman had died, and her chambers remained lifeless and hushed, like a tomb. Though Lobia must be in other memory now, having joined the multitudes within her mind, the truthsayer's ancient spirit had not yet surfaced. Anirul felt exhausted from the effort of trying to locate her, but something drove her on. Anirul needed a friend and confidant, and she dared not speak to anyone else, certainly not Jessica, who knew nothing of her destiny. Anirul had her daughters, and though she was proud of Irulan's intelligence and talents, she didn't dare place such a burden of knowledge on the girl either. Irulan wasn't ready. No, the Kwisatz Haderach breeding program was too secret. But Lobia, if only she could be located in other memory, would be suitable. "Where are you, old friend? Must I shout out and awaken all those others inside me?" She feared taking that step, but perhaps the benefit would be worth the risk. "Lobia, talk to me." Empty boxes were stacked along one wall of the unheated apartment, but Anirul had avoided packing the dead truthsayer's meager possessions and sending them back to Wallach 9. Since Gaius Helen Mohiam had preferred a different set of rooms for herself, these quarters could remain empty for years in the sprawling palace before anyone noticed them. Anirul walked through the dim, austere rooms, breathing the chill air as if hoping to feel spirits stirring about. Then, taking a seat at a small roll-top desk, she activated her sensory conceptual journal from the Sustone ring on her hand. The diary hovered in the air, visible only to her. This seemed an appropriate, contemplative place for Anirul to organize her private thoughts. She was sure Lobia would approve. "Wouldn't you, old friend?" The sound of her own voice startled her, and Anirul fell silent again, surprised that she had begun talking to herself. The virtual diary lay open in front of her, waiting for more words. She calmed herself, opened her mind, using Prana Bindu techniques to stimulate her thoughts. A long, slow breath eased out of her nostrils, barely visible in the frigid air. A chill coursed her spine. Shivering, Anirul adjusted her metabolism until she could no longer feel the cold. 4 unadorned glow globes near the ceiling dimmed and then brightened, as if a mysterious power surge had rippled through the air. She closed her eyes. The room still smelled like Lobia, a comforting mustiness. The late truthsayer's psychic energy lingered as well. Removing an innocuous-looking ink plume from its receptacle on the desk, Anirul held it with both hands, pressing it between her palms and concentrating. Lobia had used this instrument often when sending coded transmittals to the mother school, where she had been an instructor for years. The old woman's fingerprints were on the pen, along with discarded skin cells and bodily oils. But the ink plume was a primitive method of writing and would not serve for this sensory conceptual journal. In its place, Anirul summoned a sensory pen and raised it in front of the ethereal pages. In the night stillness, in this place where Lobia had spent so much of her life, Anirul wanted to describe her friendship with the remarkable truth-sayer, documenting the wisdom she had learned from her. With brisk strokes, she entered a coded date on the paperless page. Then her hand hesitated. Her turbulent thoughts became murky, blocking the flow of words she wanted to write. She felt like a child in the mother school, given a difficult assignment, but unable to marshal her thoughts because the proctor superior was staring at her, scrutinizing her every move. The glow globes dimmed again, as if shadows were passing in front of them. Turning abruptly, Anirul saw no one at all. Refocusing her tired mind, she turned back to her journal and set about completing what she'd come here to do. She managed only 2 sentences before her thoughts drifted away like chime kites caught on the wind. The apartment was filled with the faintest of ghostly whispers. She could imagine Lobia sitting beside her, imparting wisdom, counseling her. In one of their many conversations, the old woman had explained how she had come to be selected as a truth-sayer, how she had shown more ability than hundreds of other sisters. In her heart, however, Lobia would have preferred to remain at the mother school, tending the orchards, a duty now ably performed by Reverend Mother Thora. Regardless of her personal wishes, a Bene Gesserit performed the duties assigned to her, such as marrying the emperor. Lobia had found time in her assignment to give scolding lectures to sisters stationed in the palace, even to Anirul herself. While doing so, the cantankerous woman would wag her withered stick forefinger to emphasize each point. With Anirul's eyes closed, the memory of Lobia's laugh drifted back, a cross between a cackle and a snort that came at odd moments. The two women had not been close in the beginning of their relationship, and had, in fact, experienced some friction over access to the emperor. Anirul found it disquieting and frustrating whenever she saw her husband and Lobia engaged in extensive private conversation. Sensing this, Lobia had told her with a wrinkled smile, "Shaddam loves his reins of power far more than he could ever love any woman, my lady.